Welcome back to Midnight Grappler Animals, home of Flub Nation. I'm your host, Lan, and with me I've got a man in the midst of a construction site. Salt, what are you doing there? Get out of there.
I know, I'm in the way of the unstoppable march of capitalism's progress.
What are they building around you?
Supposedly they're fixing the train tracks. But,
pretty,
you know, that's
pretty
what
goddamn
say.
Loud for just train tracks.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of associated crap. You know, it's an economic nightmare, if you will.
Folks, it's San Francisco. That's all you need to know.
That was a springboard for you, though.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it's, you know, talking about the economy.
Ah, yes, the economy. That is what we're talking about today, isn't it?
It is.
Salt, we're back. We're back. We're so very back.
We are so back. You all loved our first installment of Ditkoology.
Yeah, and now we're back with Ditkonomics. And if you're wondering why we went with Ditkonomics this time, last time we studied the art of a man across many decades. This time we're looking at a man who has been... I think the best way you can put it is a man that has a lot of financial problems, and it really starts to show in the work that he's doing. Especially
hack
the last
era,
one.
Hack era.
So we're back with another look at Steve Ditko's works. We got four works this time. We're going back to the very, very beginning of Ditko's work as a comics artist. And then we're pretty much ending near the end.
Piggybacking on that, last time a lot of what we did was condensed within almost a decade period, maybe slightly more. All over the place. So this is the beginning and the end, like you said.
This is like 40 years, I want to say. The first one we're talking about was published in 1953, and then the last one we were talking about was 1991. So, yeah, just under 40 years, which is insane to think about.
Yeah,
but yeah, if you're wondering what Steve Ditko was publishing in 1953, that would be Paper Romance, which is a story inside a comic called Daring Love Number 1. That's right. Before Steve Ditko was known for objectivism, he was doing ditzy romance comics for key publications.
Ditzy? I'd say hot.
Hot? You would consider this hot? Okay.
For the time.
You know what? You're right. For 1953, this is pretty salacious. Yeah. I will say. Yeah.
Well, and for Ditko too, I'm not used to Ditko really like focusing on, you know, the curvature of some babes. You know, they're kind of more accessories most of the time.
Yeah, maybe this is before he had found objectivism. You know, he's a corrupted youth. He's one of the protesters that Peter Parker wouldn't be so fond of.
He had to embrace it. He had not embraced Volcellism yet.
This was actually Ditko's first published work ever, according to what I could find. And surprisingly or unsurprisingly, it's very difficult to find. We'll actually include a link to where we read it in the show notes for this episode, which you can find by joining us at patreon.com/midnightgrapplerAnimals. There we go. Always be plugging. Hey. Salt, do you want to just jump right into it? I don't, there's really not much more preamble to go on with this one.
Yeah, it's a saccharine pablum about a fickle woman from the countryside who's dissatisfied with her current boyfriend but falls in love with him after he pretends to be a sophisticated city man. It's like the lyrics to Pina Colada. I more just want to talk about the art here. What about you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The art is what we're here for. The story just completely flew over my head. Like, not in the understanding sense, just my eyes were... not paying. Bro was yapping. That's all I'm going to say. Bro was yapping. So much text.
They were probably getting paid by the word back then.
Probably. You know what? Probably.
Did you figure out who the writer was?
It was Steve Ditko. It was him writing.
You're certain?
Well, that's what I'm led to believe. I don't know. There might be a ghostwriter. We don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if Ditko had that dog in him, is all I'm saying. That's all I'm going to say.
Got you. Yeah, how did you find the art in this one, Lan?
I feel like there's always this feeling when you go back to an artist's old art, you're always trying to piece together how they got from that to the art that you more commonly associate with them. So for me, it was like trying to figure out where stuff like his head shapes, his figures, stuff like that would come from. So this is, 1953, right? So when you're considering what comics back then look like, this is pretty standard, I would say. Like, there was no real house style or anything, but like the prevalent style seems pretty much in line with this. The faces here, I think the faces here might be the one commonality there is between this and Squirrel Girl. Or it's like a bell curve almost in terms of like Ditko's understanding of how to draw faces, where like this is at the very, very front end of the curve where he's like just starting to understand how to draw faces, and then Squirrel Girl's right at the end of the other, he's on the other side of the curve. That being said, though, he does have a really solid understanding of how to capture mid movement stills. Like, there's that panel where our character Lisa is diving into the water. And, like, he's managed to capture that action really well. Again, this is a freshman work for Ditko. And so in that regard, I think it's pretty good. Even other things like heavy shadows, like there's a panel where she's, like, sitting by the moonlight. And you can see, like, the moon's in the background. She's got, like, very heavy shadows. And also a bit of, like, sheer going on with her skirt there, where you can see the outline of her legs in the shadows too. Other than that, though, there really wasn't much that could sort of link me to his, you know, the top of the curve work, if we're gonna say it like that. There is one panel actually where the head shape does look very similar to the head shapes he would draw in, like, Amazing Spider-Man. And I'll also include all these, everything that I'm talking about, I'll include references to those in the show notes, too. Yeah, what about you, Salt?
Well, I do know at this time, Ditko was doing a lot of uncredited assistant work, which makes me wonder if he had an uncredited assistant on this, and that might explain why some of the, some of the signature looks might be a little bit different than we're used to. I think we're looking at something that's largely Ditko, but perhaps some of the faces, perhaps some of the inking, perhaps even some of the panel layouts might have had an assist from someone else.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. I think especially with the backgrounds, because like some of the foliage here doesn't feel very Ditko-esque.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I think back to what you said, it is fascinating to see how an artist starts and like what changes along the way. So if you're someone who is interested in how Ditko developed, it's funny to go back this far, and it does surprise you.
Yeah, I think the other thing is like I never pieced together, like in my mind, it never occurred to me that he would be doing work as early as 1953.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like at this point, I think he was 26-ish. I want to say because he was. I'm looking at his Wikipedia now. He's 1927, so 1927 to 1953. That's like 26. Math heads, correct me in the comments or whatever.
Well, and if memory serves correctly, before that he had been doing some technical art for the military before then.
Yeah, he was.
But yeah, I think that's not much more to say there. I mean, it does have something in common with our next book, which is, again, this is some of the most sensual Ditko art you'll ever see.
Yeah, absolutely. And the next book that we're actually talking about is Stalker #1. Anyone remember Stalker?
They should. This character's rad. I wish I knew about him earlier.
Yeah, I wish DC knew about him too. Am I right?
Hey,
don't worry. They'll pull him out. They're desperate. I know they are. He's coming back. I'll tell you that much. Yeah, so Stalker. We're jumping ahead to 1975 now. This book was written by Paul Levitz, penciled by Steve Ditko, and guess what? It's inked by Wally Wood. This book only got one published run. I think it was only like 4 issues. And then the character kind of just faded into obscurity, much like many characters that were introduced in the 70s. But, you know, he'd show up sporadically in other DC books every now and then. Other than that, there really isn't much to say. This is like a sword and sorcery type book, which was pretty popular around that time. Anything else to add before we talk about the book itself, Salt?
I love DC Bronze Age. If you're a Bronze Age head, like, tap in. This is the book for you.
Yeah, this book, I think I have the least to say about this book, because I think most of my comments boil down to, hey, this is pretty good. This is pretty good.
Yeah. I have some art notes. There is the final, there's like, it's not quite a splash, but it's a really big panel on the last page of Stalker riding away on a horse. Like, it's amazing what Ditko pulls off here. Like, he knows architecture, but he's also so in tune with psychedelic expression that this looks like a metal cover. I'm sure that's an overused description, but like it rocks. Like, this is so fun if you like sword and sorcery stuff. My one other art note is Wally Wood, and I what I imagine is Ditko did his first pass, and then Wood came in, and anytime there was a lady, gave her like big old titties.
Yeah. Wally Wood was definitely inking with one hand. We'll say
yeah, exactly. In our notes, which you can find on Patreon, I've juxtaposed the queen with one of the Disney queens, and it's like clear that Ditko lifted the design. It's like almost a one-for-one costume swipe, and then just big old double E cups. It's
big
great.
Honkers, just huge torpedoes.
Thank you, Wally Wood.
Thank you, Wally Wood. Salute you.
With one hand.
With one hand. Yes, of course, with one hand. So the way that I read this was extra legally, we'll say. So I got to actually read this with the ads that would show
up. Oh, nice.
So I forgot that Hostess ads were happening around this time. So they would do like the comic ads. So I had a jump scare the second I flipped, quote unquote, flipped the first page, and I saw Superman advertising Hostess Twinkies. Anyway, go ahead.
One of these books had one of the Hostess ads with Batman and Robin.
Oh my God, that's yes. Oh,
it's like, oh look, Batman. Pigeon Woman is stealing the Hostess cakes. And then it's like the beginning of the political correctness era because she shouts back at them, it's Pigeon Person! Like, oh, okay, this is the start of culture war is here in comics in this era.
Yeah, wokeness in 1977. am I right, fellas?
Yeah.
Or sorry, am I right, folks? Yeah, Hostess ads aside, I pretty much echo everything that you're saying with this one. You know, Ditko's just balling here. The design of the demon here, DeGirth.
Oh, crazy.
Hella juice. Hella juice in this one.
Yeah, I don't mean this pejoratively, that it feels like he had some Doctor Strange villain designs left over.
Yeah, this definitely feels like something that was left off the cutting room floor in some regards. But I think that the other thing is, like, unlike the next book that we're talking about, this one definitely feels more divorced from Doctor Strange in its aesthetics, which is, I guess, ironic considering that this is a sword and sorcery book and the next one isn't really, right? Like, you would think that this would be the book that apes Doctor Strange more right. closely, right? But this one feels very unique comparatively. Yeah, it's just like a really solid book throughout, and I'm sure if I read the next, what is it? What did I say? Four? Three? Whatever. I'm sure it'll be just more of the same, you know, like good stuff. Like it's not like a hidden gem or anything, but it's like if you're somehow aching for good comics and you've somehow not, like, I don't know. Well, like, I'm trying to think of a situation where someone would want to read Stalker, and I think it would be something like this, where it's two idiots trying to figure out what Ditko was doing in the 70s.
Well, it's surprising for a few reasons, and, you know, if you're a Bronze Age completionist, it's surprising because DC hadn't really dug into anti-heroes yet. Like, they had popped up sporadically, but, like, Stalker is a bad dude. Like,
yeah.
And that's what's funny about Ditko working on it. Like, you wouldn't think Ditko would work on a character so morally compromised, and yet he did.
Yeah, this is post-Doctor or Mr. A.
Right.
So, maybe he sold out. Maybe. I don't know. It's funny thinking about, like, when you hear about Ditko going like, oh, I don't want to work for you anymore. I've got my morals to stick to. And then, like, 10 years down the line, he's back working for them. Like, this is not... the reason I didn't even specify a publisher is because there are multiple publishers that he's done that with.
Yeah, it really makes you wonder, like, why he was so bad with his money. Like, what? Like, he wasn't drinking. He wasn't doing drugs. Like, was he just collecting baseball cards or something? I don't know.
Like, I gotta know what it was that had him, like I don't know. Was he crawling back? Who knows? I sure don't.
What if he was falling for, like, whatever the predecessor to the Nigerian print scams were?
Oh, like, someone sends him a letter and, like, says, oh, I'd like you to join my new publisher, Narvel Publishing Company. And he's like, oh, yeah, shit, Narvel.
I just need an upfront investment from you. And he just falls for it every time.
Yeah, slide me a 50. I'll create a new character for you. Rack Shade, here you go.
Yes, let's talk about Shade the Changing Man. I am so intrigued to hear how this book affected you.
So, Shade the Changing Man. So Ditko had come back to DC in 1975. He did Stalker, he did a couple other books, and then in 1977 he comes out with Shade the Changing Man, which runs for 8 issues and then gets canceled in the midst of DC's big 1977 implosion. Crazy enough as it is, it gets a 9th issue a year later as a part of DC's canceled comics cavalcade in an attempt by DC to keep hold of their copyright to the character.
Very weird, because this dude doesn't
really...
Very
weird, just to begin with. And then, you know, like 20 years down the line, it gets revived at Vertigo. Peter Milligan and Chris Bacciello do their book. It's fantastic. Everyone goes crazy for it. And then Vertigo dies and then comes back. And, you know, the whole thing. But all of that doesn't capture the craziness of the book itself.
Yeah.
Where to begin?
Well, tell me your first impressions, because I got a lot to say.
Wow, I didn't know Jack Kirby was writing under a pseudonym and drawing
exactly.
under a pseudonym. Like, I'm sure you can make the case for Ditko's art looking Kirby-esque in the 60s, but... And again, it makes sense, because he worked in Kirby and Simon's studio back in the 50s, and probably for a while after that, but, like... This feels so, like, it almost feels like borderline plagiarism in some parts. Not
there's
even
another...
just of Kirby. Not even just of Kirby, but himself, too.
Well, and there's a third artist I want to talk about here, and that's Jack Cole. You'd probably best know Jack Cole if you read superhero comics from his work on Plastic Man, but he did like a lot of editorial type comics. But the reason I mentioned Jack Cole is there's a gangster in here named like Jake Cole. And it's like, oh, like that's Jack Cole. Like that would make the most sense.
No salt. When you see, he foresaw the coming of J. Cole.
but when you see the way that Shade like stretches and distorts, it's like, oh, he's Plastic Man.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, I loved this book. I love how awful and weird and like contrived it is, but like mixing up Kirby Cole and, as you said, like plagiarizing himself with the Doctor Strange shout outs, like it's so weird. Just don't even read the text to this book. Ignore the text and read the pictures, and it's glorious.
I will say the art here, there was like, when I was reading it, I think there was like a solid half of this book where I was like, oh, this is just regular Ditko comics from the 70s. And then Shade the Changing Man starts becoming the Changing Man, the titular yes. Changing Man, and the art just skyrockets to like crazy heights.
Yeah, I don't think people are used to seeing Ditko do that type of cartooning. I don't know what to call it. Like he can do psychedelic, but seeing like characters' faces distort, like it almost reminds me,
like Funhouse. It feels very Funhouse.
Yeah,
a lot of the distortions he does,
like Stardust the Super Wizard, even just with how unhinged some of these expressions get. In the chat land, I just shared some Jack Cole comics, like, you know, his non-Plastic Man stuff, and like I see that influence in this book.
Let me take a look. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Especially with how limber and, like, not to make the pun here, but elastic that the character looks.
Right. And the villain is basically Orion of the New Gods.
Yeah.
This thing shouldn't exist. It's so freaking strange.
It's got, like, the boomstick, too, and this, like, I am honestly surprised it made it to 8 issues.
I know. That's got to be the longest a Ditko series went, because he gave up on the Creeper and Man-Bat, presumably because of wokeness.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But those are like at 6
and
issues in.
Pigeon people.
I want to talk a little bit about, like, here we go. Dit continuity.
Huh? Dit continuity. Wow.
Yeah, that could be our third one.
Take notes, folks.
But you know, Rack Shade is Shade's alias, and it bears so much in common with earlier characters like Vic Sage, Jack Ryder, Rack Shade. Those are all very similar sounding names. I'm joking that they all have the same tailor. They all wear that same suit and hat. But
I was honestly like, I had to do a double take because I thought that was him, you know, like doing a question cameo in the book.
Right.
At first.
The nature of disguise and technology and how that interconnects, like each character really does build upon the previous one. Like Jack Ryder builds upon the foundation of the question, and Shade the Changing Man builds upon the Creeper. And I think a really notable way too is like there's this very strange sense of teleportation in this book. Like you think it's an important thing and it doesn't really matter, and like that's a thing in the Creeper too. Like it all feels like Fugazi. Like he mentions all this technological gobbledygook and it doesn't ever play into the story. It's pure expressionism.
Yeah, it's like it's so I don't know, it's like fluid almost with its narrative. Mm-hmm. Where it like or laissez-faire, I think, is the better way to put it. Because there's a lot coming at you, but none of it really, really matters. What really matters is just whatever's happening in the moment. So, you know, like in that regard, I guess it is like a resounding success.
I mean, it went for 8 issues.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, art-wise, what sticks out to me here is, of course, the Kirby and Cole, but also, this is the first time I'm used to seeing Ditko work with such a thicker line in a lot of places, and I love it. It works. It hits different, but it's really emphatic, especially when Shade is like turning into some weird, grotesque 11-foot tall nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, even with the smaller panels where you know, you have the classic Ditko beady eyes, but then you also have some more like, and again, maybe this is the Cole influence here, where it feels almost like Toth, like Alex Toth.
Yes, I see that.
Yeah, like artistically, it's just such a crazy grab bag. You know, like, I don't know. Like, I wonder if you were to take any random panel out of this, you know, contextless, textless, whatever, and were to show it to your average comics fan, would they be able to tell that this is Ditko?
I mean, there's certain panels that a lot of people, if they had to go in blind, they would call it Kirby.
Right. But I mean, like, even the more Ditko-esque panels, I guess.
Right.
Where, like, there's this one panel where he's sitting on a chair, you know, he's extending out a leg, and he's got, like, it's almost like he's summoning his stand, or he's got, like, this crazy Joker-looking guy behind him. And, like, the sheepish look on his face doesn't feel like Ditko at all.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah, it's like you see... Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
You do see, like, some of the hallmarks of facial expressions like you would see in The Creeper. I mean, there's so much to praise about Ditko. Like, even some of the more subtle stuff you might not think about, like interior design, like... You see inside people's apartments, and it hits you so funny. It's like everything looks a little bit off, but perfect for a Ditko world.
Yeah, it's...
And he really goes off when Shade gets into the big tussle with the villain. Like, it's great that our hero's power is to, like, transform himself, and the villain's power is to transform the world around him. And he is getting his rocks off when these buildings are, like, distorting and warping and, like, tying into knots with each other. It's so great.
So good. So what better way to segue? Sorry, I can't even do it. Our next book is not Shade the Changing Man. I don't know if it would ever be considered on the level of Shade the Changing Man. It is a book.
You can say that much. It's a book.
It's absolutely a book that came out in 1991. Marvel definitely did publish it, you know, and Ditko definitely did plot it. He definitely did do art for it.
Yes, I begrudgingly have to agree with that.
Yeah. No matter how much you want to deny it, Ditko did do art for this book. So I want to give you some context as to, like, where Ditko was at in terms of the books that he was doing when he came across or when he came up with Squirrel Girl. So yeah, Squirrel Girl, Marvel Superheroes Volume 2, Number 8. Ditko is firmly in his hack era by this point. Like, there's no sidestepping it. Okay? Listen, this is a guy who by this point, you know, he come back to Marvel, and not only did he come back to Marvel, but he was doing licensed comics at Marvel. Not even doing, like, the big stuff, right? He was doing goddamn The Further Adventures of Indiana Jones. He was doing Micronauts. He was doing US 1. Remember US 1?
Is that related to US Agent?
No, US 1 is about trucks.
Oh, sick.
It's about trucks, yeah. He was doing comics about Chuck Norris. Chuck Norris comics.
And he had his Power Rangers comic coming up. He was doing, like, I think he was doing coloring books too.
Yeah, like, this is...
Where was his money going? It's all I want to know.
What, why? Yeah. So why did he need to do this? I don't know. But he's here. We're here now, folks. Marvel Superheroes Volume 2, Number 8. The story, The Coming of... Squirrel Girl, exclamation mark. This book was
she comes.
She absolutely does come. This book was purportedly scripted by Will Murray and purportedly plotted and drawn by Steve Ditko, and purportedly colored by Christy Scheel.
I got another purported for you.
Oh yeah, what's
this gets a little off topic, but the writer and co-creator Will Murray is purportedly a psychic.
Is that so?
Yeah, he did a Nick Fury book, I believe, that depicted some kind of terrorist attack on New York in like 2000, and it was like a terrorist attack from the Middle East. I think they hit maybe the World Trade Center, maybe something else. And he said, yeah, well, I'm a psychic and I was predicting what was coming.
You know, that would explain a lot of this story.
I think the other thing that explains a lot of this story is that Squirrel Girl is purportedly based on an ex-girlfriend who purportedly was a fan of squirrels and Steve Ditko.
And was a girl, I presume.
I really hope she was a woman, but, you know, what's done is done.
Yeah, I mean, libertarians, am I right, folks? yeah, Squirrel Girl is not the character she was 33 years ago. And thank God. thank God for that.
I don't know too much about her. Like I flipped through some of the modern Squirrel Girl books, and like they're fun. Like they feature like a lot of indie art styles. There's like a body positivity and like contemporary feminism to it.
Yeah,
it feels
great.
Very accessible, like it's
the
fun.
Modern runs are all really really good.
This is not good though.
Yeah, this is it. It's like whenever. You, like, so, can you imagine someone who read the what is it, 2015 series, and was like, I wonder what Squirrel Girl's first appearance was like, and they come and they read this book. Can you imagine the trauma inflicted upon them?
Yeah, I can, because you look at that face, that close up on her face.
Okay,
you
wanna flip, okay, it's horrible. Okay, so why? Why does he keep doing the same fucking face every single time? Every single time. Like, there are panels, right? There are panels where the face, like, it's the same face, but he makes it, like, even more cartoonishly garish from panel to panel. Like... Oh
yeah,
my
God. It was like Wally Wood drawing the breasts bigger on Power Girl, but like instead Ditko is drawing that weird buck tooth bigger in each panel.
It's the ketamine stare. It's the ketamine stare.
Yeah, her eyes are bugging. It's
she
so
is
scary.
Tweaking. She is tweaking.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like
God.
It's made worse too that like she doesn't really have eyebrows, but she has this thick black like Joker makeup,
eyeliner.
For lack of a better term.
It is Joker makeup. It absolutely is Joker makeup.
She's like Insane Clown Posse fan.
I think she'd get skin cancer first, honestly, with what's going on here. On the topic,
you notice
of
Lan
the
and
art.
I are not talking about the plot here because there's no plot. Like, she
not
just
really.
Talks
I mean,
to Iron Man for 11 pages.
She talks to Iron Man. She, you know, she messes around. She beats Doctor Doom. It's funny to think that, like, even in the 2015 series, this is like an intrinsic point where, like, her ability to defeat major villains like Doctor Doom and Thanos. That's like a major like thing, right? Yeah. Here it's like, oh yeah, let's defeat Doctor Doom, and it happens in like 2 pages. It's so like, okay, so on the topic of the art, because I want to get back to the art here, I want to talk about the art that isn't Squirrel Girl herself here. I like his Iron Man. It's like fine, but it's like very commercial. Like that, the thing with the art here is, aside from the horrors he does with Squirrel Girl, everything else here is like very standard. And by standard, I mean like a Hostess ad standard. Like that's the thing that was that's a thought that was going through my mind reading this, is like, this is on par with the ads to the comics that he was doing 20 years ago at this point.
Yeah.
And like, it feels like, I don't want to say sterile, but it feels very, very, very commercial.
Like, I mean, that all first panel stuff, of all, Iron Man, dude, it is bad.
It is like, okay, you know how we were talking about how visually experimental and interesting his art was looking in Shade the Changing Man? None of that is here. Not a single element of that is here. Instead, what we get is very, very thick lines, very, very basic figures, very static poses for the most part. The backgrounds too are also just very basic. I'll say,
when Doom gets attacked by squirrels in the first panel, and all the other panel of Doom getting like shredded and bit by squirrels, it's delightful.
Yeah, like, that's like if I were to like pick apart this book, or and make it. Like, I don't know. That's like the one panel, I guess, honestly. Actually, 2, 3, 4. I'm just trying to count the amount of panels where you have Doom getting attacked by squirrels without Squirrel Girl herself showing up. Because, like, until that point, I think it's pretty, pretty fun. Pretty fun. Okay. The plot here, it's fine. Like you said, it's pretty much nothing, but it's fine. Like, I'm not gonna be like, oh, the woke mob and their comics.
It is funny to think about those kinds of guys. Like, it is funny too to like think about the guys now who forgot about the guys back then, and like they think Squirrel Girl's gone woke, and they try to insist that like this is the good era of Squirrel Girl.
Yeah, I gotta what is going through. Like, I'm so confounded by people who point to this as like the good era of Squirrel Girl comics. Like, do you know how to read?
I made that guy up. I'm sure he exists.
He exists. So you didn't need to make that guy up. I know for a fact he exists. I mean, it feels like if Steve Ditko himself wasn't the one to do the art for this book, it could be like a fine kids comic. But, you know, that's what Squirrel Girl is. Like, she's great for stories made specifically for kids in that sort of like 7 to 13 age range.
Right.
And like the story here really befits that. Again, it's just like Steve, man, what are you doing here? Get out.
The question it begs to me is like, is he trying to make her a freak? Because like, I'm almost tempted to say yes. Like, he's trying to make her unsettling.
Like, when you say the X thing, right? You know, that he had the X that likes squirrels. That really colors,
right,
my perception here is like, yeah, is he trying to make her intentionally look like a freak?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's okay.
It's not
when
great,
I
folks.
Die and meet Steve Ditko in hell, I'll ask him myself.
Yeah. But Squirrel Girl's gotten a lot better, so she made it out all right on the other end. The irony of this book is everyone else in here is cooking. I know it's not the point of the episode, but if you do run across this issue, like, there's a great Eric Larson cover. There's a bunch of splashes at the end that are really great. Do you know who did this Doctor Strange one?
I'm not sure, actually.
It's in that bottom corner. I swear I've seen that initials before. It's like SP or STP.
STP.
But
let me check. I gotta head to the wiki for this one.
same guy did this Wolverine and Spider-Man splash fighting ninjas. Ninjas were still all the rage. But while Lan does that, I'll say thank you for tuning in to this follow-up to Ditkoology. This was Ditkonomics. And I guess there is room for a third part. We can go even deeper into Hack Era Ditko.
But, what I'm like scared of is, like, if we do end up doing a third part, what is there to do? Speedball?
You mentioned it last time. Power Rangers.
Oh my god. Oh my god, yeah. What the hell does Steve Ditko Power Rangers look like?
It's that hack. I mean, it's after this, so he's even more just like checked.
He's
out.
He's tuned
so.
Out. Yeah, he's tuned. Yeah. So if you want to see that happen, let us know. If you want us to put ourselves through more Ditko hack era comics, please let us know. And before we close out, though, as always, we have our Tastemakers grab bag segment here, where we recommend things that we've been engaging with that we think you should check out. Salt, you got any recommendations?
I have two. First one is not overdoing it at the gym. Made that mistake.
Ooh.
Don't overdo it at the gym.
Ouch.
It's what okay. Did you do? Everything's fine. Just okay. Felt like shit for a weekend.
Okay.
My second one is Kamen Rider Black, again, because I recommended it last time, and we had like 30 recommendations, but I love this show so much. I don't want it to end, but when it does end, it'll give me incentive to watch Kamen Rider Black Sun again. I love Showa era Kamen Rider, and it's so much fun.
Nice. I got three recommendations this time. The first one is the movie The Holdovers. I finally got the chance to actually sit down and watch the movie. It's fantastic. It's such an amazing movie. I think for me, it really hit as someone who had that sort of like almost paternal, where like that sort of like male guiding figure in your life, I think really helps shift your perspective on things. So I think it's a really good movie, and I probably should have watched it around Christmas instead of in goddamn February. The second recommendation that I have, Yakuza 4. I feel like every time I finish one of these games, I just end up putting it in my Tastemakers grab bag. But yeah, solid game, great game. I think it gets overlooked a lot just because it's like really good at what it does, but it doesn't really do anything crazy that other games don't go crazier with, like the multiple protagonists thing. But yeah, it's a great game. I think it has maybe my favorite iteration of Kamurocho. So yeah, check that out. Play the Yakuza games. If you know how to count, you know where to start. My third recommendation, folks, it's March. If you know what happens in March, that's right, a new Sentai season has started. Bakuage Sentai Boom Boonger, or as it's been localized by fan translators, Cranked Up Sentai Boom Boonger has started.
The Fast and the Sentai.
It's great. It's honestly fantastic. It's crazy to think that Sentai is in its fourth year of being peak. Just four straight years of nonstop bangers. Meanwhile, Kamen Rider is like struggling to stick to like two good shows in a row. Yeah, Boom Boonger. Great, fantastic show. I'm sure it will continue to do just as well as it did for that first episode. If it doesn't, then I'm going to go kick myself, or I'll eat my shoe. I don't care.
I've seen a few clips. It's pretty sick. I would definitely want to watch the whole thing.
It's really nice that they've gone back to actual on-set shooting. Like mm-hmm. I'm not... King Oger was great, but I got really sick of the green screen sets by the end. So to actually have them on streets again, it feels very refreshing. Yeah, that's pretty much it. That's our Tastemakers grab bag. As always, if you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the show, we've mentioned it already like 5 billion times, but we got a Patreon. Join us at patreon.com/midnightgrapperanimals. $1 gives you the ability to vote on our future episode topics. $5 gives you a whole bunch of stuff. You can find out about it when you actually go to that link. If you can't support us financially, just give us a good review on your podcast app of choice. Please, only a good
one.
And
join us in our Discord. We've had some good chats in there recently.
Yeah, some really good chats about Argyle and Matthew Vaughn's penchant for undermining the efforts of his collaborators.
Bingo.
Yeah, links to all that down below, as well as where you can ask us questions and give us suggestions. As always, thank you for listening. Thank you for putting up with us.
And keep on grappling.
There we go.